Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Rob Meehan of Feeding Chittenden, and yesterday, Sue Minter of Capstone Community Action. In both instances, they spoke of the rising demand they've been seeing from Vermont families for food. Through the summer and fall, we saw images of long lines of cars as Vermonters waited for food boxes during the Farmers to Families food box distributions. Rising food insecurity is real, and there's more than anecdotal information to back that up. A team of UVM researchers has been accumulating data on COVID-19's impacts on food security and food systems in Vermont. They recently released their third set of results. Joining us is Assistant Professor of Public Health Nutrition, Emily Bellarmino. Emily, great to have you here with us.
Hi there. Wonderful to be here.
It's great to have you. And we will be joined by Assistant Professor of Public Health Nutrition, Senior Lecturer of Dietetics and Food Systems, Farrell Burtman. We have had a little problem with connecting with her this morning, but she will be joining us as soon as we can get a hold of her. The third member of the team is Assistant Professor of Nutrition and Food Sciences, Meredith Niles. And listeners, you can call us with your questions about the study or with your own experiences during the pandemic. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. And you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Emily, I know we were going to have you with Farrell, but right now you're solo, so it's the Emily Bellarmino show for a little while. So this is your chance to really shine out of this three-person group. It's early March. The pandemic becomes a real thing in the U.S. and Vermont. I remember I was confused, but the three of you, keep your heads up, and what did you wind up doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So even before the COVID-19 pandemic was declared a pandemic, our colleague Meredith Niles had started wondering what might happen to the food supply, food access, and food security when it did grow into a larger problem on U.S. shores. And so she reached out to Dr. Farrell Burtman and I very early on and said, you know, hey, I have this idea. Would you be interested in collaborating with me and some additional colleagues at Johns Hopkins on this project? And that's when it was really born, in very early March. And, you know, we started to think about if we were going to understand the challenges facing Vermonters and facing the U.S. population as it pertains to food security and food access, what would we want to know? And from there, we built out a survey that has then grown into a large national collaboration with data coming from a number of states, including Vermont.
Now we do have Farrell Burtman has joined us. And Farrell, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you.
How quickly did you all mobilize, Farrell, and figure out what this study should look like?
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much for having us on the call. So around the second week of March, we began talking to our stakeholders. For example, I reached out to Hunger Free Vermont, I believe on March 12th. During that exact same time, our colleague, who is the PI on the study, Meredith Niles, reached out to Johns Hopkins. Within a couple of days, she reached out to Emily and I, and we began the process of building the survey. On March 20th, we already had a finished survey that we sent out to our stakeholders to get their feedback, just to make sure that it was in line with their needs. And then we were able to turn around, and once it was piloted with 25 subjects in Vermont, we were able to get it out to the broader audience. So pretty quickly.
How did you go about finding 600 Vermonters to talk to about food insecurity?
Emily, would you really led this part of the recruitment. Did you want to talk about that component?
Sure. So initially, with our very first survey, we spoke with over, or we heard from over 3,000 Vermonters, and we reached them through a number of distribution channels. So we spoke on radio programs and had a press release go out. There were ads that went out on Front Porch Forum and through Facebook. We then did our most recent survey a little differently. So this survey that we're chatting about today reached, as you mentioned, 600 Vermonters. And we actually used a national survey firm to build out that group of Vermonters, because we wanted the sample to be representative of the Vermont population with respect to income levels and race and ethnicity. So our first two samples were fantastic. We learned so much, but we also realized that there were some groups in Vermont that maybe their voice was not heard quite as loud as we wanted it to be. So this 600-person survey was recruited differently and to be more representative.
Gotcha. And we're going to delve into the findings of this most recent survey. But what were the findings, the general findings, in that initial study?
So in our initial study, Rick, we found that about a third of Vermonters were struggling at that time. And when we think about that initial push, it was really remarkable because we were already surveying folks just in mid to late March, beginning of April, and people were already starting to feel the sense that they were able to get access to enough food to live a healthy and productive life. One of the things that we're teasing out as we move forward in our study is this perception of food insecurity, and we're trying to understand when people feel that scarcity, is it because they're not able to access food that they want, or are they not able to access food that they need? And we used in all of our surveys this USDA 6-item food insecurity module. And in this, we're starting to be able to delineate, is it that you're having to cut meals? Is it that you're having to stretch meals or skip meals? And how is that different from, say, you want to go and get a particular boutique item, and now you're not able to get it because there was a run on those items. So the suffering started early, and when we get into our third survey, it is building.
Well, Emily, reading this study, I've been really impressed by the many areas of food security and systems that you looked at in relation to the pandemic. Is that a researcher's dream to be able to get people to respond to as many different areas as you were able to?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think with all of these surveys, we've had a really robust response, and we've been able to get a 360-degree viewpoint on what people are feeling and experiencing, in part because so many people are thinking really critically about food now more than ever and trying to determine what to buy, where to buy it, what to access, where to access it, should we grow food at home. So food security and food access are something that are on people's minds more now than ever.
It's time to delve into the results of the recent study. Let's start with general findings regarding food insecurity. Emily, what do we know now about that in Vermont as we reached August and September?
Yeah, so we found that in the first 6 months of this pandemic, nearly a third of Vermont households were food insecure at some point. Between March and September. And there were some groups of Vermonters who were more likely to be food insecure. So those were lower income households, so households making less than $50,000, households with children, households that had experienced a job disruption, whether that was job loss or reduced income or a furlough. And then also respondents who without a college degree were also more likely to live in households with food insecurity.
So one in three people in Vermont are households facing food insecurity. How does that compare to the start of your research and maybe a few years ago? Farrell?
Great question.
Oh,
either one,
Emily.
Whoever knows.
Go ahead, Farrell.
So when we, it was interesting, Rick, because we, in our survey, we asked people to reflect on their food insecurity status before COVID compared to their food insecurity now. So we found in our research that about 30%, as Emily just mentioned, of Vermont households were experiencing food insecurity at some point during COVID. If we look back to 2018, those numbers are around 11%, around 12%. And so you can see a dramatic increase. But if we look at the numbers when we're asking people to reflect on before COVID within the survey, we did notice that they had a higher percentage of experiencing food insecurity. And we think it's because through the pandemic, it really changed their perception of food insecurity before and after. So what we're doing now is we're looking at what was the data in the state before COVID, and we're using that to have a baseline for what that food insecurity is now. And so we're looking at numbers that almost doubled between pre-COVID and what we're currently seeing in our survey. And I should mention, Rick, that a similar survey is being conducted throughout the United States, and other regions have had a similar experience where they're seeing that it was a dramatic increase. And if we're asking people to reflect on food insecurity within that survey during the pandemic, that they actually perceive higher levels of food security before the pandemic.
And I don't want to assume anything, Farrell, but when we say someone is experiencing food insecurity, are we also seeing more people now seeking food assistance?
Yeah, that is such a great question, and it's something, Rick, that we're really taking a deep dive into. So when we think about food assistance, we can think about it in different prongs. We have federal and state programs such as Three Square Vermont and WIC and the National School Lunch Program and an off-branch of that, the Summer Feeding Program. And so we did in the beginning in our first survey see a downtick in the utilization of those government food assistance programs. But if we look at emergency food, and that is the wonderful work coming out of the Vermont Food Bank, Feeding Chittenden, all of those different programs that are allowing people to come up to a food pantry and get food, we did see an increase in the utilization of those emergency food programs, including the National Guard effort, really starting earlier in our survey results. And now we're seeing an overall increase in enrollment in the new government nutrition assistance program. And I think it is in we must put out the kudos to Vermont Food Bank and all of those initiatives, because not only are they providing emergency food, but they're also helping connect people with programs that they qualify for. I also have to give a shout out to the Vermont school system. Mm-hmm. They were incredible on that front line, getting food to kids when they were remote learning in March. They've also really stepped up the effort to get kids enrolled in the school meal program. And with this waiver that came through, any child in a household that's 18 and under can qualify for these programs. And the Vermont school system has done a great job letting people know about that.
You have been researching this since March, but when you saw the images of all those cars turning out that were lined up for that National Guard food box giveaway, did that surprise even you, Farrell, knowing the information you knew?
Yeah, thanks for asking this, Rick. I've been working on food insecurity for 10 years, and I know that this is a problem. This is what I would consider, for many people, invisible suffering. We do not want our neighbors and friends to know if we're food insecure. And so people are not necessarily showing up and showing people that there's a need. I think what has happened is because there's such widespread suffering that people are taking what used to be stigma and concern around letting their neighbors know that they're in need, lining up for these programs, and they're now more willing to do what they need to do to get food on the table. And so the numbers and the pictures are surprising, but if I look at research that my colleagues and I have been doing for the last 10 years, we know folks have been suffering. The numbers, of course, are higher now, but there is this turn where people are willing to get in their car and show up for these lines. And so we really see it dramatically in front of us.
I want to dive into some areas that each of you have particular interest in. Emily, your area is nutrition. What did you learn about changes in diets during the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rick. So we have definitely seen changes in what people are eating as well as the quantity that people are eating. So one of the areas where we've noticed a really profound impact pertains to fruit and vegetable intake. So fruit and vegetables are sort of an undeniably nutrient-dense food. And we've seen that across the board, households reduced their intake of fruits and vegetables during the pandemic as compared to the year before. But what's really important there, I think the dietary shift that's really important to note is that food insecure households were significantly more likely to be eating fewer fruits and vegetables as compared to food secure households. So not only do we see households experiencing food insecurity, struggling to get food on the table, but we really see this shift in the types of food that they are able to provide for themselves and their families. And that could have important long-term impacts. There is strong scientific consensus around the benefits of a diet rich in fruits and vegetables. And so that was a shift that we've seen that's been really important. We have also seen some interesting shifts in intake of red and processed meats as well as seafood, which very well could be related to disruptions that the supply chains for those foods have experienced during the pandemic.
So are the food insecure households eating more processed foods? Is that what you're seeing?
You know, that's a question that we are looking forward to examining in a future round of our survey research. The only processed food that we asked about specifically were processed meats, and we saw that consumption of processed meats had gone down. But it will be really interesting to get a feel for some of the other processed foods that are common in many of our diets. Because, you know, dietary changes can have both the short-term and long-term impacts, and trying to understand them will be a really important piece of understanding the not only food security implications of the pandemic, but the nutrition security implications.
And can we draw any conclusions as to why the amount of fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables, has dropped in those households?
Oh, great question. So I don't have a specific thing that I can point my finger at, but there's certainly some hypotheses that we're developing. We've noticed that our respondents are increasingly concerned about the costs of food. Fruits and vegetables are often considered more expensive food items, yeah. So cost could factor into it. It is possible that access could also be an issue. So things like transportation and the frequency with which people are going to stores have also been disrupted during the pandemic, and that could impact access to fruits and vegetables.
We're going to take a quick break for CBS News. We'll be back with Farrell Burtman and Emily Bellarmino, and we're going to talk about this very interesting survey, this study they're doing on food security during the pandemic. You can join the conversation. Our numbers are 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and we're discussing food insecurity in Vermont and looking at how the pandemic has affected that. UVM Senior Lecturer of Dietetics and Food Systems, Farrell Burtman, and Assistant Professor of Public Health Nutrition, Emily Bellarmino, are two of the researchers involved in a recent study that's been following these issues since March. Their most recent findings have just been released. And listeners, you can call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 with a question or comment for our guests. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Farrell, I know you're interested in what the pandemic has done to our bodies. Do you have data yet on that?
Yeah, thank you, Rick. We are just starting to look through this research, but what I'm really interested in is how the pandemic is impacting emotional eating. And so we are building off of, we've taken four questions out of a larger survey that looks at intuitive eating and the psychological relationship with food. And so we've asked four questions in this most recent survey to understand what that relationship is between emotions and consuming food. And we're finding across the board at least 40% of our respondents are experiencing some type of emotional trigger which is turning them towards food, whether it's boredom or anxiety or just feeling that higher level of emotion. And I'm particularly interested in this experience because as a dietitian, I'm concerned that if people are turning to food to soothe themselves, and then later down the road start to experience some level of concern about how their body is changing, whether there's body dissatisfaction or feeling like they've gained too much weight, what are they going to do next? And New Year's is around the corner. I'm personally, as a dietitian, very concerned that people might turn towards fad diets or quick weight loss. And we know that when you have that sort of drastic change in your dietary pattern with food restrictions, you can set yourself up for future weight gain. And so at this point in our studies, we're trying to understand if people are connecting with their emotion and their cognitions when they're eating, asking themselves, why am I eating right now? Am I hungry or am I eating because I'm stressed? So that we can better program later on as people start to maybe experience dissatisfaction with their body, you know, especially in the new year, but as we move into next year.
And during this pandemic, we are kind of at the crossroads of the two things you mentioned, boredom and stress. So those could really be factors that weigh on us. Emily, what did the data tell us about barriers to food assistance programs?
Oh, what a great question. So we actually found that some of the barriers that people are experiencing pertain to difficulty traveling to apply for programs. So more than a third of our respondents said that the difficulty physically reaching the program was a struggle that they were experiencing, which suggests that some of these online or remote enrollment waivers are helpful for families during the pandemic. The state government has been very proactive in applying for waivers that would allow some additional flexibility in program application. And our data suggests that those types of waivers are incredibly helpful.
One of you mentioned earlier the issue of stigma when it comes to going to a food assistance program to get some help. What are those issues surrounding stigma?
I'm happy to talk about that, Rick. This is Farrell. Over the years, we've thought about what are our general barriers to using nutrition assistance programs. So we use past studies to inform these questions. So items that we asked our respondents to think about was, are they worried about the paperwork? And the paperwork is sort of a broad stroke. Not only the paperwork that they have to pull together, but if they have deeper concerns about privacy, is that a barrier? We also asked them if they don't want to rely on food programs because they value personal independence. And as somebody who grew up in Vermont, I can, especially in regions of the state, one of the wonderful aspects of our Vermont community is this ability to be autonomous and independent, and in fact, 35.1% of our respondents agreed with that statement. And as Emily just mentioned, difficulty to travel, also worrying about personal assets if they qualify. We've seen a shift with higher income Vermonters because of job disruption now becoming food insecure, but they might still have those assets, and so that could potentially be a barrier. And then finally, we asked if people were worried that others would find out that they're utilizing this program. And I alluded to this earlier in my discussion, that we are in a situation right now that is starting to normalize reaching out and getting help, whether it is lining up, as we talked about, to get emergency food assistance, or saying, you know what, at this point, I am going to, in fact, enroll my child in a school meal program because ultimately it is best for our household, and I see other households doing this as well, and it normalizes it. But that said, you know, we still had agreement that these stigmas exist. I would say that the highest agreement is that 35.1% where people value their own personal independence.
Interesting. Emily, what were there any concerns that people had about food early on that seemed to abate as the pandemic wore on?
Oh, what a great question. So we did see in general that a lot of the concerns that households were experiencing did ease off during as we moved through the pandemic. So some of the challenges that that people were really concerned about initially were that there wasn't going to be enough food, that they if they were able to enroll in programs, that they might not be able to maintain their enrollment. They could lose access. Understandably, especially right at the beginning of the pandemic, there were many, many concerns about accessing food in stores. So stores would not have, they wouldn't have food, there would be supply disruptions, and you wouldn't be able to get what you needed. I think we all saw that in our own trips to the grocery store with toilet paper, but we had similar concerns related to food. There were also a lot of concerns about food safety and whether food could be contaminated. And I think there has been a really great effort on behalf of the government and some of our leading science communications organizations to communicate that food is not a high risk. Food is not a high risk item when it comes to transmission. So we've seen some of those concerns go down over time.
Farrell, we did see a rise in people turning to local foods, especially meats, when there were concerns about that Emily has mentioned over meat processing. What are we seeing in the most recent data?
So we're seeing, and I'll pull up the numbers for you, Rick. Mm-hmm. We are seeing an upward trend that people are relying on our local food system. And our team is currently working with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture to better understand from
the producer end, from this local farmer end, what are they seeing, and how can we best understand what they need in order to shift over potentially to a more technologically based ordering system and distribution system. When we look at the meats in particular, we do notice that about 43% mentioned that they've had a reduction in those that are food insecure in their meat consumption, even more so in the seafood consumption. And I think part of it was this concern about scarcity. When we were seeing nationally that the food supply chain might have had some disruptions, especially around meat production, we saw that disruption. But what we're in particular seeing in Vermont, and we're actively comparing this to other states, that our local food resilience, our local food system resilience, really been able to step up and provide those needs on a local level. We certainly see that in the media, and we're noticing those trends in the study that we're doing with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. We've not yet released those findings, but we are seeing that Vermont is well positioned to adjust and meet these supply chain needs at a local level.
And let's go to a call from Britt, who's joining us from Montpelier. Good morning, Britt.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Farrell. Good morning, Emily.
Good
morning.
What's your question?
Good morning. Yes, I'm really curious if you're going to continue studying the connection between food insecurity and possible increased susceptibility to COVID virus. I'm curious because in my dietetic internship, I'm learning a lot of patients who come into the hospital with COVID infection who have the vitamin deficiencies, like vitamin D deficiency or thiamine deficiency, who may already be suffering from food insecurity. They often do not fare as well as those who are coming in without those deficiencies. I'm wondering if you'll be taking a look at that in your study.
All right, Britt, I'm just going to say that's better than any question I've asked today, so thank you so much. Who wants to take that one from Britt?
I'm happy to take that on. Britt, thanks so much for asking this question. I'm just, first of all, thrilled that you're getting that on-the-ground experience with your dietetic internship. We are not currently studying micronutrients, but we can proxy understand what is happening. So in particular, when you're asking about thiamine, when we're considering the types of foods that people are consuming, we're in the process of expanding our dietary quality questionnaire to better understand access to whole grains, which would allow us to see how, for example, people are able to access thiamine through their whole grains versus highly processed, shelf-stable grains, which would be maybe fortified in thiamine, but potentially not enriched or have that lacking. You did also ask about vitamin D, and I think that this is a really important consideration. So in Vermont, we are in the period where we're not getting access to UV in the way that we would in the summer, and our body produces its own vitamin D. We can get supplementation to vitamin D through, for example, dairy products, and in some cases, fruit juices are fortified for folks that are plant-based. And I have also seen in the literature, Britt, that vitamin D is part of the therapy that they're looking at in the CDC moving forward for COVID. And I'm particularly interested how Vermonters are going to fare through the winter with what typically the pattern is a vitamin D deficiency, and more so are Vermonters of color who typically have higher levels of vitamin D deficiency. We're not studying this in particular, but we're certainly keeping our eye on what's happening, and we're looking at proxies such as dairy and access to other foods that would help supplement these deficiencies.
Emily, what did you find when it came to people raising their own food, hunting, fishing, foraging, those types of things?
Oh, great question, Rick. So we found a lot of our respondents over 40% engaged in some type of home food procurement this year. For many of these individuals, they were pursuing this activity for the first time or doing it more this year than they had in the past. So this could have been raising a flock of backyard chickens, engaging in fishing or hunting behaviors, foraging for things like mushrooms, or gardening. And it's interesting because we collected both quantitative data, so where participants had the ability to respond to closed-ended questions, and we collected qualitative data. And certainly in our qualitative data, we have heard from participants a real interest in home food production, and several people mentioned victory gardens. You know, like this year I'm really growing a victory garden because I want to be more self-reliant when it comes to food. So we are very excited about digging deeper into those data in particular.
And no pun intended when you say digging and talking about gardens. Farrell, can you summarize the main implications the pandemic has had on food security and systems here in Vermont?
Yeah, I think that the main implication is that we do have weaknesses in our food system. Vermont has been trending very well nationally when we look from state to state. So Vermont does have more resiliency than we're seeing in other states. And yet, 30% of Vermonters are suffering. And so I think it really shines a light in those cracks in our food system that must be addressed. And as I mentioned before, Meredith and Emily and I have been working on this for years. COVID has exaggerated this need. And moving forward, we need to work with our stakeholders, our policymakers, to make sure that we can find the balance between public health measures and access to nutritious foods that are also culturally appropriate. And so I would charge us to continue to understand what is happening, but also to make sure that we are advocating, especially for those who are underrepresented and are not able to advocate for themselves, whether they're stigmatized or not as active in being able to communicate these needs with our policymakers.
I'm going to call this study nutrient rich because it really does have a lot of deep, great information, and it's easy to digest. Emily, why did this collaboration work with the three of you as a team, the third being Meredith Niles? Do we still have Emily? Yep. Well, Farrell, then I'll ask.
I'm here.
Okay. That's all right.
I said I think it's just because I have fantastic colleagues. Meredith and Farrell are amazing to work with, and I think that we complement each other with different skills and different interests and areas of expertise. So Farrell has this rich knowledge of dietetics, and also she really has the intuitive eating cap on, which is so helpful. Meredith has done so much research with farms and farmers and trying to understand decision-making at a food systems level. And I come with a much more public health perspective. And so I think the marriage to ask and answer these particular questions is fruitful, not to throw in another pun.
You're leading the league in puns this morning. And Farrell, this is part of a larger initiative. So tell us about how that will be working.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And just to add on to what Emily just said, I also want to acknowledge that we have an incredible college, an incredible department. Our department chair has been really encouraging our collaboration and everybody getting on board. Our college, the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, has not only been providing funding, but has been providing communication avenues to share our message. So thanks to them. We are working with a group of researchers, very equally, all members at the table, from Johns Hopkins University, from Arizona State University, which also happens to be one of my alma maters, and the University of Arizona. And together we have an executive team of folks, not only university faculty, but full-time researchers, postdocs, doctoral students, and master's students. And we've been able to open access share our survey and our findings so that there's a lot of equity and inclusion in getting access to what we're doing. And that has brought in 15 additional states to create this larger NSECT collaborative. And through this NSECT collaborative, we are allowing each state to do their own regional and local study built off of our survey, but really take a deep dive into the needs of those areas. And then we get together every 2 weeks and we talk about our findings. We talk about how we're going to analyze the data. And just yesterday, we spent time thinking about how we can take these different state data and collaborate to understand how different regions of the United States are being impacted in different ways.
That's Farrell Burtman. She's a senior lecturer of dietetics and food systems at UVM. And we've also been speaking with Emily Bellarmino, an assistant professor of public health nutrition. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Rick.
And Meredith Niles.
Thank you, Rick. A real pleasure.
All right. Take care. Meredith Niles, Assistant Professor of Nutrition and Sciences, the third who conducted this study. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then be back here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When people think of the bastion of progressive politics and policy in Vermont, they often think of Burlington. Hey now, let's not forget Brattleboro. The town of Brattleboro Select Board has adopted a new set of emissions goals designed to align the town with Vermont state emissions goals. And the Select Board is considering a separate ordinance to limit the amount of money landlords can charge upfront for rental housing. Here to speak with us about those developments is Olga Peters, staff reporter at the Commons in Brattleboro. Good morning, Olga.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. And you?
Was really happy I got to hear some news before coming on because, you know, I've been so busy I never actually get to listen to the news.
You're always reporting it. Listeners, exactly. You can ask Olga a question about what's happening in Brattleboro. You can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Olga, I said Brattleboro is a bastion of progressive thought. How close am I to the truth?
I would say you are pretty spot on. In fact, most people, I would say, consider themselves, you know, left and left of left in Brattleboro.
What are some things you can point to that provide examples of that?
I think for me, in my coverage, what I see is, you know, some of it's what people might consider very obvious, you know, rallies happening quite often in the downtown or different protests. A number of very active social organizations focused on the environment and social justice and racial justice. But I would also say where I see it is in the high number of very engaged community members who come to select board meetings, who come to town committee meetings, who are always consistently showing up to talk about the issues they care about.
When I look at things like the co-op, the rebuilding after the fire, CCV's presence there now, plans for the train station, this seems like a town with some serious momentum.
Yeah, I think sometimes people feel a little frustrated that the momentum isn't faster, like there's not more momentum and sometimes change happens so slowly. But yes, I would say that over time there is a lot happening, even if sometimes it, you know, we in the news don't hear about it until it is almost ready to be done, like the train station or the reopening of the Brooks House.
What are some of the challenges that Brattleboro is facing right now?
I would say a lot of the challenges that a lot of Vermont communities are facing, you know, we don't have the strongest economy as we would like to have. Just like the rest of Vermont, wages are not as high as they could be to keep up with the cost of living. I would say one challenge Brattleboro has that maybe some other Vermont communities don't have is because it is a border town to two different states. Mm. As much as Vermont likes to think of itself as its own little special island, it's not.
Right.
And so what happens in Massachusetts and New Hampshire impacts Brattleboro. Definitely. And people can make choices about where they work, where they live, where they spend their money. That is a little more, I think I hear planners refer to it as leaky. Mm. You know, it will bleed outside the community. It's not people aren't kept in the community like they might be elsewhere in Vermont.
That's a great perspective. I noticed that when I'm in Brattleboro, and same with Bennington, they have New York State instead of New Hampshire, but mm-hmm. the same thing, two other states, and they kind of look in those directions more than they kind of look north to Montpelier. Right?
Well, this is so true, although I think a lot of people, at least in what likes to call itself the Forgotten Kingdom, southern Vermont, they would say they look to the east and the south because Montpelier does not always look to them, which might be fighting words.
Well, we don't want to get you in trouble with everybody in Montpelier yet, so we're going to move on to some of the things that have been happening with the Select Board, and we're going to start with this idea of rentals. Let's talk about the ordinance that was on the Select Board agenda last night. What would that do if it were passed?
So just to give listeners context, Vermont in general, Brattleboro has a very, very tight rental market. In fact, most statistics I see say that a healthy turnover in a rental market is about, or a vacancy rate, is about 5%.
Mm-hmm.
And Brattleboro is lucky if it's 0.05%.
Whoa.
So it's extremely tight. And a lot of people argue that that's one reason rents can be much higher in Brattleboro than some surrounding communities. So a group of community members who are part of an organization called Tenants Union of Brattleboro. There mm-hmm. we go. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Got together and submitted a proposal based on one similar to Burlington's and similar to one that was also passed in Barrie, which I think recently might have been rescinded. But basically what it would do is try to lower the barriers to renting apartments for people with middle to lower incomes. And so by the way they propose to do this is to cap the amount that people have to pay up front. So many communities you see first, last rent, and a security deposit. Right. And this would cap those amounts and hopefully reduce, in Tubbs' view, again, one of the financial barriers to getting into apartments.
Did you learn anything new at last night's meeting about what the future might hold for this proposal?
Not so much. It's still in the works. This proposal has been interesting. This isn't the first time it went before the Select Board.
Mm.
The first time it went, it made it through the first reading. As people may know, for an ordinance to go through municipal process, it has to go through at least two readings. And a number of landlords came forward and said, you know, this could put a financial burden on us, and the only outcome we would have, or the only recourse we would have, would be to raise rents, is the argument some landlords made. And so the board decided they needed more information about whether or not capping upfront payments would actually solve some of Brattleboro's housing issues. And so they put the ordinance aside, gathered some more information, and now it went back to the board last night for discussion. And I would say most for the most part, it's an ongoing conversation still at this point.
So I'm assuming that instead of first, last, and security, it would be first and security. So the landlord wouldn't have that last month kind of cushion in case someone leaves without paying their rent or without a notice.
That's a really good summary, yeah, that I think of the concerns that a lot of people had.
And landlords are really enjoying some of the lowest occupancy rates anywhere. So, how crippling would this be, I guess, is the point that Tubb would probably make.
Very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. It's interesting when we start talking about that aspect, how crippling would this really be? We start, at least in Brattleboro, getting to some of the philosophical differences we have in our community about how the economy should be run. There are a number of people, at least, who have been vocal at the select board meetings who say that housing is a right and therefore it should not be a business. And therefore, no landlords, mm-hmm. basically, to very oversimplify the argument. On the other side, you have landlords saying, it might look, I own three buildings, so it might look on paper like I'm rolling in it, but my margins are thin. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not really making loads of money here off this business. And so for Tubb, the argument back to that has been, is it a viable business? People should be housed more than anything. And again, we get into that I'm stuttering because, again, it gets to that philosophical argument. And that all kind of depends on where you come down on that philosophical argument.
Does Brattleboro have a particularly high rate of homelessness right now?
If you had asked me before the pandemic, I would say compared to the surrounding communities, yes. But I have to say one of the silver linings of COVID-19 is that the local organizations who support people who are dealing with homelessness have been able to get at least the people they know about mm-hmm. into hotels and into shelter and into support services.
Yeah.
So right now, I think the number's almost zero.
We're going to take a call now. Christian is calling in from Johnson. Good morning, Christian. Thanks for joining us here on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to also give a shout out. Brattleboro, you had characterized it progressive. I call them common sense. They recently passed a lot of zoning reforms in early September, basically allowing the building of, multifamily units in most of their neighborhood areas. And I think that's really common sense in getting access to building more houses, more affordable housing units. And I think right across the political spectrum, I don't see how you can be opposed to it. So progressive, yes, but also just really common sense.
That's a great point, Christian. Thanks for calling. What can you tell us about that, Olga?
I'm really glad Christian brought that up, and I don't have the exact zoning ordinance in front of me, so I may not be able to go into deep detail, okay. But he's right. Part of that information gathering process that I talked about with the ordinance, the rental ordinance, the director of planning, Sue Fillion, came back with a number of statistics, but she also talked about some of the zoning changes the town has been trying to make. And one of the main, to basically put it in a nutshell, one of the main things the town is doing is trying to open up more areas for multi-use buildings. So in other words, a commercial enterprise on the bottom floor, and then the upper floors being for housing, mm-hmm. for example, or opening areas of the town that might have been zoned only commercial and allowing more residential housing in there. In fact, I think Sue mentioned that since that September, it's an interim zoning ordinance, so it still has to go through some more municipal process to become a codified zoning ordinance. Mm-hmm. But since it went in September, I think she said close to 18 new units of housing have been built.
Wow.
Thanks to that ordinance. So, yeah, Christian brought up something that's a really big deal.
That is a really great call. Thank you, Christian. And Olga, it's time to talk about the climate now. The Brattleboro Select Board recently passed a set of greenhouse gas emissions goals. What are the goals?
So the goals actually, and thank you, Rick, the goals actually align with what the state passed earlier this year, the Global Warming Solutions Act. And so they are a series of benchmarks that starting with by 2025, the town wants to have reduced its carbon emissions by 26% of what it admitted in 2005, the emission levels of 2005, and it decreases from there up until 2050, where the town hopes to be carbon neutral.
With the state passing that law, why did Brattleboro have to pass anything extra?
I'm glad you asked that question, because that was the same question that was asked at the select board meeting when the town energy committee submitted this proposal along with the sustainability coordinator, Stephen Dotson. Some of the arguments that the town committee made was that by aligning with the state goals, it can create much more of a momentum of a regional effort. And for the town specifically, it could have benefits such as when the town applied for state funding, it could move them further up the line for state funding because they've already met certain benchmarks.
Well, how will Brattleboro know down the road if it is indeed making that progress towards those goals?
That's interesting. I'm laughing because what I find so interesting about this proposal is that the town of Brattleboro has, to its benefit, a number of very, very active and committed climate change activists, community members, however you want to characterize it. Mm-hmm. And so in so many ways, this proposal is one of many things to come forward before the town. In 2002, the town passed a resolution to reduce emissions. In 2003, the town energy committee actually put forward a town energy plan to work on those emissions. In 2019, Brattleboro Common Sense put forward a proposal to representative town meeting, which is Brattleboro's version of annual town meeting, asking the town to take common sense measures. And I say common sense because that was the wording in the ordinance, to reduce its carbon emissions, such as lowering the thermostat in the winter and having staff wear sweaters or long johns instead of raising the thermostat, or instead of air conditioning, using air conditioning in the summer, to have fans and wear lighter clothing. And that ordinance, that proposal was defeated, but I think it's part of the wider conversation around how do we reduce our carbon footprint in Brattleboro. And what is interesting to me too, and I realize I'm getting to your question.
I understand. I'm a patient man, Olga.
You are a good man. Thank you. What I find interesting about this is, you know, if we're going to really reduce our carbon footprint, it is something that has to happen on all levels of society, not just at the municipal level. However, one of the things the town keeps bumping up against with many of the proposals that come forward is that they're asking the town to basically step into people's homes and regulate the residential and the commercial side of society as well. which is not always within the town's remit. And so that was one of the issues that came up at the select board when this proposal came forward. The other issue that came up, and this gets to your question, is it was just a proposal with goals. It did not contain any benchmarks besides those emission reduction by such and such a date. It did not say, let's reach that emission reduction by moving all to electrical cars or electric cars. It didn't have any strategies or tasks like that.
So goals without solutions, it seems, is what was proposed. It also, didn't it measure against emission amounts from the past that don't really exist?
Yes. Yes. And that was another concern the board brought up. And Stephen Dotson, the sustainability coordinator, is that there's no data for some of the years that they want to use as benchmarks, specifically 2005 and 1990. Dotson said that they can extrapolate the data using other sources, but at this point that data doesn't exist. So in some ways the town doesn't know what 26% reduction by 2025 will look like.
And yet,
you know,
this
how
passed.
Much that actually is. It still passed, yes.
All right.
Which I have to admit surprised me, only because, you know, that long history that I just gave you, it felt a little bit to me, and this is just my opinion, that the conversation around climate change is much more developed in Brattleboro than I felt this proposal contained. I did reach out to Dotson and the Town Energy Committee to see if they're planning to bring anything forward at future meetings in the way of strategies or goal tasks. At this point, I have not heard back from them.
And so Olga,
I don't know.
Is there any funding attached to helping the town government or businesses reduce emissions?
Not at this point, no.
So they're making a statement. But as you said, it could put them in line for state funding somewhere down the road if they are moving towards these goals.
It could. It could. And in this proposal, Dotson did mention creating a plan that, to me, hints towards maybe having tasks and strategies in the future. There was no timeline for this plan. And again, like I said, I reached out to them and I haven't heard back about whether or not this plan is on the books or for when.
We only have about a minute and a half left, but I do want to kind of talk about the economy of Brattleboro. I know Brattleboro Retreat has been going through some difficult times, and I just wondered how that has impacted the economy of Brattleboro.
Oh, wow. In some ways, I would say the town hasn't felt, specifically with the retreat, and I think you're referring to the series of programs that will be closed over this month. And the retreat, for those who don't know, have both outpatient and inpatient programs, and they're shifting their offerings to offer mostly inpatient programming. And to do that, there is a number of layoffs and program closures. So That specifically we haven't felt yet, because the layoffs and the full program closures won't happen until January. But I will say it has a lot of people worried, because the retreat is one of the large employers, not just in Brattleboro, but in Windham County. And so to lose that number of jobs and that number of programming on an economic level is tough.
Yeah.
Not to mention the programs for people who need them.
Well, Olga, this has been an interesting discussion about Brattleboro. I can't wait to have you back on. Olga Peters is a staff reporter for the Commons in Brattleboro. I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Anytime.
And we'll be back after this CBS News update to talk about antiques with Brian Bittner. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Sometimes you're just destined for a career in a particular field. Chip Carey might have spent his youth saying that he wasn't going to be a baseball announcer, but sure enough, he followed his dad, Harry, into the profession. On Monday, we had Chester Abbott, who grew up on a dairy farm and set out to try other things, but ultimately returning to Vermont to run an organic dairy farm just seemed natural. And I'm sure Brian Bittner could have been many other things, but growing up and getting to know the antiques business so well, it seems he's perfectly suited to be the owner of Bittner Antiques. Brian Bittner joins us now to talk about the deep roots his family has in the antiques business and to share some insight into what he does. Brian, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. And listeners, you can call us with antiques questions for Brian. Our numbers are 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Brian, start us off by explaining what qualifies as an antique.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, like with a lot of businesses, it becomes a little nuanced. What I always learned was that in order for something to be an antique, it needs to be 100 years old. But quickly, if we look at automobiles, for example, they only need to be 25 to get an antique license plate on them. So as somebody that owns a quote-unquote antique business that goes by the name of Bittner Antiques, I handle many things that are both 100 years old and older, as well as newer than that that might be collectible or valuable for other reasons.
We usually have this image of someone at least as old as those antiques to be the people who actually fancy antiques, but you're a young guy, so why do antiques speak to you?
Yeah, well, I think antiques are a really important part of our history. It's a connection to that history. And, you know, collecting things has been something that people have done for generations and I think will always continue to do. So to maintain some of those things and put them in the context of the history that they originated from and you know, certain things will give people enjoyment or you know, I guess that's the right word, for a variety of reasons. So, you know, maybe it's because they're inherited or maybe they want one of every, you know, pocket watch that was made in 1890 or, you know, there's so many reasons for it. And I guess a variety of those motivations do drive some of my collecting as well as buying and selling.
Well, it's also in your DNA. Let's travel back through the Bittner family tree and take us back to where it all got started.
Yeah, sure. So my grandmother was born in Cavendish, Vermont, in the homestead that her grandparents, I think, started, which is outside of Ludlow, between Ludlow and Chester, where I grew up. And after my grandparents got together in their early 20s, and started a family, my grandmother's parents in Cavendish were aging and I think passed away. And it was about that time that my grandfather had some knowledge base of auctions and understood that auctions could be a place to sell real estate as well as material goods and the things that come in that estate. And so he expressed interest in auctioning off the estate that was my grandmother's family. And this was maybe about 1960. And I think that was his first big venture into the antique business and also the auction world, just placing a small distinction between the two of those because he had both an antique store and antique business, but as he also did auctions. That was a large part of his business. So that's sort of where it started.
And then your father took up the mantle, right?
Yeah. So my grandfather, my grandparents had a really big family. They had 13 kids. They lived in Brattleboro and Westminster West after that. My grandfather was into, you know, selling real estate and had a farm and collected old tools and bottles and various in sundries. And he made a full-time business, you know, in the late 60s into doing auctions and antiques full-time, in addition to sort of, you know, helping out with the family farm. And my dad picked up the business at a young age. So I think, you know, when he was a teenager, he was already starting to help out with some of the auctions, even in terms of calling some of the sale, you know, being up on the podium and selling some of the items. And so my brother and I picked up the business from our father as well as my grandfather while he was around.
Have you ever called an auction?
I have, yeah. So I went to the Missouri Auction School in 2014 and ran a couple of sales myself. So I'm a licensed auctioneer in the state and have done some calling.
I love that. Wow, that's really neat. Hey, I'm going to just sidetrack you for a moment because you mentioned Chester, and I'm thinking this might have had an influence on you living in a town like that, because there's a couple – it's going to be like a little travel log for people. There are two things that I really love about Chester. One is the Yosemite Fire Station and the Stone Village, right? And the tell us just a little bit about those.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, I say I grew up in Chester. It wasn't the only place that I grew up. So I'm not as versed as, you know, probably many listeners right now. But for those that don't know anything about them, there is a stone village in Chester, which I think has maybe 20 or so stone homes, some of which were part of the Underground Railroad. And within a half mile of there is the Yosemite Fire Station, which sadly I believe is still vacant at this point. I think there have been, you know, numerous grants or, you know, fundraising attempts to renovate it. And I hope that still happens. I'm sure that in elementary school we took a tour of the fire station, and I don't remember everything they told us then, but it's a beautiful building.
It is. It has this tall tower, and I finally did some research to learn that they would hang the hoses up in that tower to then drain after they were out on a fire call. So it's a really interesting building. All right, back to auction antiques. So when someone thinks they have something that you'd be interested in, Brian, you know, what do you try to learn initially from them?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the things that I'm looking for are making sure that there's a match on the items and my interests, my markets that I have. So I guess, you know, most antique stores or antique businesses, rather, are unique in which markets they tap into and how they do that. And just a little background of my current business, I don't have a storefront, so I'm somewhat limited in terms of the larger items and the walk-in retail customer. I don't have access to as much as, say, the collector or the connoisseur or sometimes institutions, things like that. So the first step for me is making sure that the items that are being presented or potentially available for sale are going to be a good match for my markets.
And then what is it that will get you, I assume you will then pay a visit to someone if it seems like they have something that you'd really be interested in. What does it take then to get you to schedule a visit?
Yeah, sure. So definitely knowing that those items are available for sale is an important piece. I'm plenty busy with my business in buying and then selling items as opposed to, say, doing appraisal work or consultation work, which I have done in the past. But I don't have a lot of extra time for that, and my motivation does tend to be more towards the buying and selling. So if things are available for sale, given the right price point, and they are of interest to me, you know, either personally or known to be of interest to my clientele, then, you know, that's the first place to start. And then, yeah, arranging a time that I can see those things in person. Sometimes people will start with photographs, but eventually we need to either, you know, we need to schedule an appointment, and that could either take place here in Shelburne, or more likely and more often, I'm making house visits statewide and outside of the state, frankly, to look at things in person and then buy those items.
He still makes house calls. Brian, you mentioned that you prefer antiques that are on the smaller side. So what are things that interest you?
Sure. Yeah, I do a lot of my business with antique smalls and other collectibles, you know, older collectible types of items. So the big categories for me would be paintings and other artwork, silver, like flatware and serving pieces, and other artistic forms of silver, and then jewelry, watches, coins, and again, a whole variety of other antique collectibles. So think historical items, maybe political or sporting related, old toys, military things, so on and so forth.
And are there some things you go out on and you say, I'm buying this to sell, or I've got to have this for myself?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that I end up buying and recognize that I have some sort of attachment to those or enjoy having them around and hang on to them for a while. If you saw my house, you would see pretty quickly it's full of a lot of different antiques and collectibles and artwork and accessories and, you know, all kinds of various things, which, you know, they are inventory. I intend to sell them at some point. But if you saw it, I mean, I'm making no attempts to sell them currently. So
post-pandemic, of course, when Brian invites you over for dinner, just remember you can make an offer on just about anything in the place and he might take you up on it.
It is all for sale.
Hey, Brian, let's take a call from Rich. He's calling from Starksboro. Rich, thanks for calling us today on Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, good to be calling. Brian, good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
You've talked quite a bit about old photographs. I was wondering if you could tell me what makes an old photograph valuable. Just to give you some background, I have quite a few photographs of people I think were my ancestors and stuff like that, but I have no idea who they are because the people in between and the generations between passed on before I got an idea who they are. And so they have no meaning to me. What about to you?
Thanks, Rich.
That's a great question, and I appreciate it. Photographs are collected by many people for many reasons, and you're hearing from somebody who is a collector themselves of photographs. I've got quite a large collection, and in that collection there are many different subject matters. So speaking towards the ones that you described, it sounds like they're probably dating from 1900, maybe, you know, 40 or 50 years older than that, and maybe somewhat newer. And we don't know who most of these people are. When we're looking at portraits, it's a variety of reasons. So the earlier pictures, the first photographs started in about 1840. They're called daguerreotypes. And if you look at them in one direction, it looks like a mirror. You'll see a reflection. But if you tilt it just slightly, then you'll start to see an image built in. From that type of photograph, we go to tintypes and ambrotypes, which are on glass. And then finally, we get to paper photographs, which last for quite a while. So we're looking at the dress. We're looking at the composition of the photograph. Sometimes people would bring things like a toy or a doll or a family pet. Other times people would be dressed up in their occupational uniform, maybe for military or carpentry or you name it. I have photographs of circus performers, political figures, military people, you know, and many others.
Give us an example, Brian, of, you know, where someone had something and they thought there was some value, but when you showed up, it was really more valuable than they even thought themselves.
Yeah, I mean, this happens frequently. there was an estate call that I made maybe last fall, and there was some better jewelry that I was, you know, intending to look at, and it was put out there for me to look at, and I did. I picked out a number of things that I bought. And then on the floor, you know, on the side, there was a box that I think I made a general inquiry about, and they said, oh, that's just going to Goodwill, you know, it's the costume jewelry maybe. And I let them know that I should probably look through it, to which they were open. And I think I spent something like $700 or $1,000 from that box, too, that was just, you know, headed for Goodwill. So it happens frequently. I think it's important for things to be looked at. These markets shift quite a bit. There are collectibles that now are, you know, highly sought after and have value that maybe 20 or 30 years ago, somebody's exposure to the antique business, you know, would have led them to believe that those things are worthless or, you know, don't have a market. So I think especially for somebody that maybe doesn't have a lot of exposure to the antique business, or if that exposure was just, you know, from years ago or from what relatives passed on, I think it's really important to have anything looked at, even if it doesn't look like much.
On the flip side, how do you break it to someone that what they have really isn't of much value?
Practice. Yeah, I mean, that happens a lot too, right? Because we have shows like the Antiques Roadshow and American Pickers and many others where there are a lot of things that are being shown that are valuable things. And I appreciate that now the roadshow will show you some of those things that were appraised years ago and they're not worth much, or at the end, you know, the things that didn't pan out to be as valuable as a lot of people believed, because that happens very frequently.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, you mentioned watches is something you are interested in. I own about 50 of them, but mine are more recent and more arty than they are seriously valuable. But what do you prefer in watches?
Yeah, generally I'm drawn towards the work watch, and that could be, you know, for sport, like for diving or flying a plane or, you know, driving a race car, things with a stopwatch function, with a larger bezel for diving or for telling time in a time zone that you might be traveling to. It tends to be more of the work or sport related watch than, say, the dress watch on the flip side. Being somebody that is wearing these watches, I'm obviously looking for men's watches that are maybe from the 1950s to the 1980s. That's usually my sweet spot.
Has there ever been an instance where there's something that is out of your sweet spot and you go to a call and you'd say, oh my gosh, this is not what I would normally be interested in, but I've just got to have it?
Yeah, well, I'm looking at it from two angles, right? So sometimes I'm buying for myself as a collector that those things I'm going to sell down the road. But then other times, you know, strictly from a business standpoint, I have no problem handling something that I don't want to keep, but to be able to make a profit on that item. And, you know, a lot of my business is done in collectibles and antiques that you'll never see me hanging on to, that I don't need to keep, but I recognize their value and I recognize their interest amongst other collectors.
Are there any lessons you learned from your grandfather that you still use today?
My grandfather was a true Vermont gentleman. I guess, you know, maybe at the time they wouldn't call him a Vermonter. He was born in Michigan. but he was a real gentleman and had a great dry sense of humor, really good wit. And I think those are the big lessons that carried on to be honest and fair with people, you know, have fun, you know, talking to people and doing the business. Those are some of the big takeaways.
Brian, we're almost out of time, but just tell us, you know, about the business. How big is it now and what future plans you might have?
Yeah, sure. So I've got 3 full-time employees. We just brought on our latest employee. He moved up from New York City and has a strong background with rare and antiquarian books. So he's bringing strong knowledge base. And then we've got a couple other employees who are already in Vermont, one who collects old bottles and Vermont-related ephemera and sorts of items. And yeah, we're always expanding. We're always interested in taking on bigger estates and projects. Keep an eye out. We'll be looking to secure a piece of real estate in the Chittenden County where we can sort of have a headquarters of all the storage that we need, but also, you know, photography and eBay sales offices.
All right, Brian, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us today. It's Brian Bittner of Bittner Antiques, and that's our show for today. On Vermont Viewpoint, we'll meet you back here again tomorrow.